Okay, hi everyone. I have a very special person with me on the phone today. His name is Brian Forrester. For most of the listeners of this show, you'll probably know who he is. But I'll just like to mention that this is a person who has a very, very good YouTube channel. He has, by the latest data, about 23,000 subscribers. And he has more than 8 million views online. He is currently assistant director of the Paracas History Museum in Paracas, which is south of Lima. You may have seen him also on some of the Ancient Aliens episodes. So this is a person who is deeply involved with the issue of a very ancient, our very ancient history. And he, just like some other people, he's trying to figure out, is the material written in our textbooks about our history correct, or are we missing something? So, hi, Brian, how are you?
Oh, I'm great, Jan. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Oh, thank you. It's entirely my pleasure. I've been a fan for a few years. I did see you on the Ancient Aliens. And the episodes were quite good, but to be honest with you, I'm even more impressed with your YouTube channel. It's quite fantastic. And I have to be honest, I think you're actually doing a very good service to humanity. This is what I think. Initially, when I saw your YouTube channel, I thought, why is Brian doing this? Why is he posting this information for free online for everyone to see? And then I thought, yeah, but the more you look into this, the more you look into the mysterious objects and building techniques which occurred throughout the world, but mostly in Peru, you want to go there, you want to be there, you want to see Brian, and you certainly want to go to one of well your hidden Inca tours, which you do from time to time, and maybe we will discuss this a little bit later on. But first, Brian, I wanted to speak about your about how you developed your interest in this topic, ancient monuments and ancient history. How did it start for you?
I suppose it started from early childhood. I think a lot of children are interested in mysterious subjects just by nature, such as castles, mythology, etc. But when you start to unravel the fact that some of these mysterious things, like the Sphinx in Egypt, etc., most likely were not made by the people that we've been taught they were, then it makes the story far more intriguing, and that's why I started to do quite extensive travel and, in fact, live in Peru in order to explore all of this firsthand and on a very frequent basis as well.
Yeah, you mentioned on your side that you have been to Hawaii. What brought you to Hawaii? Was it ancient monuments or was it something else?
Actually, it was the weather to some degree because it's so beautiful there. My parents used to travel to Hawaii every winter, and so when I was 12, they on my insistence, they took me and my brother. Again, since childhood, I've always had an interest in native cultures, and so the Hawaiian culture was one that fascinated me. And so I went there when I was 12, and then I went back several times and actually lived there. 1995 and 1996, I was involved with a Hawaiian project to build a giant voyaging sailing canoe, and by doing that, it gave me access to some of the old people who knew the real history of Hawaii, which is quite fascinating.
My knowledge is not very deep in relation to Hawaii. However, I once watched a movie, a documentary about a Hawaiian lifeguard. I'm not sure if you have heard of this guy. I can't remember the name right now, unfortunately. But he was quite famous in Hawaii, and he, I think, he won some surfing competitions. Does that ring a bell to you?
Yeah, his name was Duke Kahanamoku, and he was actually an Olympic champion. He was what's called a water man, and that's someone who is very proficient at swimming and surfing and paddling canoes and things. So he was an astonishing Hawaiian athlete who became a world champion at water sports.
And if I'm not mistaken, he passed on tragically.
Actually, I'm not sure if he did or not. He died several decades ago, but he was he was an incredibly famous person. They even the United States even made postal stamps out of him and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting place. I had a chance once to go to Hawaii. I didn't, and I still regret it. Anyway, you're now stationed in Peru, and you're involved with some of their ancient history. You have a lot of interesting videos, and I'm not sure where to start, but let's start with some of the strange rocks made out of andesite or diorite, which you come across and which are not very famous. These are rocks, stones which are not on the major tourist destinations or itineraries, but you've come across them and sometimes you feel them. On one of your videos, I think it was Hector who once mentioned a story about Cusco, and that maybe once upon a time it was an underground city which was blown up after a major cataclysm. And maybe some of those strange stones, which are carved in a strange way, are just the remnants of this underground civilization. Can you elaborate on this one?
Well, that's very true. The thing is that there are certain buildings in Cusco, as well as in the surrounding area, which are made out of this hard, very hard material of stone called andesite. Some people call it diorite, and as well as granite. And they are megalithic in nature, in that each stone weighs quite often several tons, and they don't fit in with the same architecture that we know that the Inca were responsible and capable of. And so I think Cusco as a city, which basically its ancient Inca name was the navel of the world or the belly button of the world. I honestly believe that the Inca discovered Cusco about 1100 AD and that it was an abandoned ancient city. And then they built all of their buildings around these ancient structures. And then when the Spanish arrived, the Spanish tore down a lot of the Inca buildings and built their buildings. But fortunately for us, some of these very, very ancient buildings, as well as wall sections, et cetera, still exist. And the reason why I love to do the tours and especially have people like engineers and stonemasons with me is that they, in every case, they've just looked at these and said, there's no way that a Bronze Age culture like the Inca could have constructed some of them. They're just far too precise, and the stones in some cases are just far too large. I mean, even getting confirmation now from a Peruvian PhD anthropologist who has lived in Cusco all of his life, and he believes that Cusco is much, much older than the Inca themselves. It probably at least 10,000 years old.
10,000 years old. Yeah, you sometimes mention on your videos at least two cultures, maybe three cultures, including the Inca. And the more ancient cultures are the Hanan Pacha, the first world culture, and the Uran Pacha, the second world culture. And the legend which I described about an underground city which was blown up probably belongs to the Hanan Pacha period, because we know that in Cusco right now, if I'm not mistaken, there is an ancient castle, the Coricancha, which is still visible. You can still go and see that. But even this second culture, the Uran Pacha, which built the Coricancha, this is not the Incas. Am I correct in this assumption?
Well, that's true. The strange thing is that what I look for in the archaeological books, etc., is I look for things that honestly aren't logical. And one of the stories is that the first building that the Inca ever made was the Coricancha because it became their spiritual center. But the precision of construction of the Coricancha is superior to any other building in Cusco or the area. So either the Inca went backwards in terms of their technical ability, or they simply discovered the Coricancha, knew that it had amazing subtle power, that it was built by a superior culture from the distant past, and so they adopted it and used it as their spiritual center.
Yeah, it's very strange, and I guess unfortunately for us, right there where we can see those amazing monuments and amazing stonework, we can also see some inferior stonework, and I guess the mainstream archaeologists look at that and they say, well, you see, the inferior was the first attempt at building a wall, and then when they had money and time and they improved their techniques, they built the better walls and the better monuments. Can you give me any examples where it's, let's say, obvious that it was the other way around? The better monuments were built first, and then it was the inferior imitations.
Sure. Well, the obvious example of that is, of course, in archaeology, the deeper you dig in the ground, the older you're going. And so there are several examples in Cusco where the superior construction is underneath, or is the first layer, and then on top of that is inferior work. There are some really great examples of where the Spanish built on top of Inca work, and the Inca work was on top of earlier work. The Spanish work is actually the most inferior, it's on top, and the superior work is at, especially the foundation, is at the bottom.
Yeah, and I guess it's quite obvious if you go and see that for yourself.
Yeah, as that's the, one thing I love to do is give people a day tour walking around the Inca part of Cusco, and I can show many, many examples of where, where that is the case. It's not just that there's one, it becomes a really obvious pattern after a while.
Sure. I recently read an article. It was a website trying to debunk the ancient. Well, the ancient aliens hypothesis and also the ancient civilization hypothesis. And what they were saying is that, well, those walls in Peru especially, they're quite fascinating. They're quite complex to do, but they're not this complex in 3D. And by that I mean they're only complex on the exterior, and they're not, and the same perfection is not visible on the interior or on the inside. You have any comments regarding this?
Well, definitely. The thing is, again, walking through Cusco or even Machu Picchu or some of the other sites, you can see that there was a massive earthquake that happened sometime in the very distant past that pulled some of the walls apart. And what we can see is what the Inca did is that they made the front of the buildings that were made of stone or stone blocks. They made the precision very, like it's very good work. But because many of these walls are partially torn down, when you look on the top of the wall, you can see that in behind there are major gaps. And so what the Inca were trying to do was they were trying to copy the work of the very ancient builders. But the work of the ancient builders is perfect from the front to the back. And many of the joins are actually not straight lines, they're curves. So when you see the curve in one piece of stone, you look at the next one, which used to fit perfectly with it, and it has the mirror image curve. So what it, the complicated thing is trying to figure out what kind of technology was at use, because I don't think we in the 21st century have the technology that these ancient people had in their possession. It's incredibly mysterious.
So I guess what you're describing about the building techniques is a complicated puzzle. So they're not just putting a puzzle together on the exterior to make it look good. They're doing this right across the wall, which is sometimes a few feet wide. It's quite astonishing. And you have a very good. I have stolen a very good quote from you. I've put it on my site. You were saying, I think it was on Ancient Aliens, the ability to fit perfectly fitting stones of several tons in weight together, so that a single human hair can't fit in between them, is not a question of sweat or man hours. It's a sorry, it's a question of technology, and I have to agree. I'm not an engineer or really a historian, but the building techniques seem to be quite amazing, and it seems like they did that not because they had a lot of time or a lot of slaves, but because it was relatively easy for them. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I don't personally use the term that it was easy for them. I simply believe that that was the state of their technical capability. And because they could do it, they did do it. And the reason why I use the human hair example is because a number of different authors and filmmakers have said you can't fit a piece of paper or a credit card in. And that's actually quite a thick piece of material. In many instances, you cannot fit a human hair in between these stones. And I've seen other examples where, because Cusco is a reasonably rainy or wet city, there are stones that are so tight fitting that the calcium from the rainwater has actually fused the outside of the stone together, so the water itself couldn't penetrate them. It's quite beyond belief.
So nature is working with the builders of the monuments. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, and also the important thing is that all of these buildings were, of course, earthquake proof, but that's not the reasoning behind the precision. I think it's because they wanted the stones to be in as close contact as possible, because they were utilizing some kind of vibrational energy. And so it was important that the energy be able to move from one stone to the next. If you have any kind of material like cement or mortar or anything like that, that disturbs the flow of a possible energy going through the building.
That's an interesting topic. You sometimes mention energy on your video blogs, and you also mentioned the acoustic properties of the stones and of the buildings and of the walls. And just recently, you uploaded a video from Egypt, from inside the Red Pyramid, where you did some testing with the School of Chemetology. Can you tell me something about the purpose of this acoustic testing that you did?
Well, sure. I mean, of course, the conventional story is that especially the pyramids in Egypt, which are on the Giza Plateau area, conventional history thinks that they were built as tombs for the dead, you know, the dead kings, the dead pharaohs. But the problem is that when you see much of the work done by the dynastic Egyptians, you see a lot of hieroglyphics on the walls. In fact, basically every square centimeter of a wall is covered by hieroglyphics, because it tells the story of the king, what the king or pharaoh achieved, what he owned, etc. But inside the Great Pyramid, for example, there isn't one single hieroglyph. And so that doesn't make it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
There is one. I think there is one. And recently some German amateur archaeologist went there to try to prove that this hieroglyph was basically put on later on. Are you familiar with this story? I think they have tried to apologize for what they did.
Well, that's true. That's up in what's called the relieving chambers, which are above the king's chamber. But that that cartouche with hieroglyphics is painted on with a paintbrush. So when you look at the astonishing precision of how the 2,300,000 blocks of the Great Pyramid were put together, no king would allow somebody with a quite sloppy paintbrush to mark his name and who he was in that kind of style. So I think, and others believe that that actually was done much, much later. And the two Germans you talk about supposedly took a sample of this red ochre paint. And of course the Egyptians are very angry about it. Sure. But what they were attempting to do was, because the paint would have had some organic material, it means that the paint could be carbon-14 tested. And if the date of carbon-14 testing was anything other than about 4,500 years old, then that changes the date of the construction of the pyramid.
Sure. Yeah, you mentioned that no pharaoh would allow painting in his tomb. This would probably have been an insult punishable by death. Very close to the pyramids in Giza, I think, is a place called the Serapeum, where we have underground chambers, and we have 20 boxes, some of them weighing more than 50 tons, inside those chambers. And on those, they have how do you call this, sarcophagus, where they put the dead pharaoh. They do have some some writings on the walls, and those writings are carved in; they're not painted. And I believe on your channel, I saw some comments that even those writings, which were engraved in the stones, even they could have been put on later on, and not by the original builders of the Serapeum.
Well, yeah, and the thing that adds a lot of evidence to that is the fact that the precision of the surfaces of the granite stone boxes. These boxes are actually with the lid, the boxes weigh up to 100 tons. And some of the surfaces are so flat that they are within 2/10,000ths of an inch of being laser perfect straight. And yet the hieroglyphics look like they were done with a nail, you know, with a carpenter's nail, incredibly poorly, not even straight lines. And so it's quite clear that the boxes were made first, and that it's only on one or two of these boxes that there are hieroglyphic writings, but the very inferior hieroglyphics were applied to them. The Serapeum itself is almost from a science fiction set, because you go underground, and it's a hallway with these side channels or niches. It's all been cut out of the limestone bedrock, and inside at least 20 of them are these up to 100 ton boxes that could have fit several pharaohs. One of them could have fit several pharaohs in it. They never found a pharaoh. They never found anything in any of these boxes. And so the mystery is, why were they made, and how did they move the stone, which supposedly comes from Aswan, which is 500 miles away?
Yeah. And from some of the pictures, I saw that our archaeologists who discovered the place, because the stones and the lids were so heavy, they actually blew up with dynamite part of the boxes to be able to peek inside. Is it that heavy?
Well, it is. Sorry, that's the dog. But the the lids weigh. It's been estimated that the lids weigh probably 30 tons each. Each lid is cut from the same piece of stone as the box is, which is very intriguing. And they could have, as I say, they are approximately, I think, 11 feet tall, 4 or 5 feet wide, and about 11 feet long. They're massive things. And the niches that they fit into, theoretically, you couldn't, because the hallway is so narrow, you couldn't theoretically remove them out from the niche that they're in and turn the corner to get them into the hall. So they're... It's a very, very mysterious place, and it's only been reopened for less than 2 years. So anyone going to Egypt should definitely go to the site called Saqqara, which is quite close to Giza, and see the Serapeum. It's very, very enigmatic place.
Yeah. I want to cover two topics in relation to Egypt. And one is Rapa Nui in Easter Island. There is a wall there which has become quite famous, which is quite ancient. And by the looks of it, its building techniques looks very similar to what was done in Peru, but also to what was done in Egypt, and more specifically in the Khafre temple. Do you find any similarities when you go? You have been to Easter Island and obviously Peru and Egypt. Do you find any similarities in the techniques used by the stonemasons?
Definitely. The one you're referring to is at a site called Vinapu on Easter Island. And there are two others which have again this stone fitting together almost like organic shapes. And the precision again is less, the tightness of the fit of the stones is so good that you could not fit a basically a human hair or a piece of paper in between them. Most of the work on Easter Island is far cruder, especially the work again which is above. It's usually the foundation work which is of this incredible level of sophistication. The Polynesian people most likely didn't have the technology to be able to do this extraordinary work in these few examples, and so I think that Easter Island was definitely visited by people thousands of years before the Polynesians. Strategically, it's located approximately 2,000 miles off the west coast of South America. So, if you were a seafaring person on a ship, it would be the perfect place to stop if you left the west coast of South America in order to collect food and water. So it's a very amazing place. And Dr. Robert Schock was there with me. Some of the giant stone human-looking figures that are there, because of the weathering on the stone, he has no problem in saying that they could be 12,000 or more years old.
Okay, every time you mention a word or a person, I can go in an entirely different direction. I just wanted to go back slightly to the acoustic properties of some of the monuments. You have a few videos regarding acoustic or energy properties, and sometimes you mention just escaped my mind. The chupas, sorry, the chupas in Peru, and they probably had some acoustic properties as well. Probably they had something to do with energy production, but specifically about the acoustic properties. Well, you probably understand that any stone has some acoustic properties. Even if you go to, let's say, a bathroom and you want to sing there, it has some acoustic properties. Why do you think that it's those rooms, those places, their acoustic properties are somehow more special or maybe intended by the builders?
I think they were intended by the builders. In the case of the Chulpas at Silustani, in general, there are these round towers, and instead of being wide at the bottom and narrow at the top, which is, the normal way that you would build something because you want the foundation to be as big as possible, they're the other way around. They're actually narrower at the bottom than they are at the top. So they flare outwards, which is quite odd. But also, I was inside one of them with engineer Chris Dunn, who wrote the Giza power plant, and we happened to have a device that emitted sound, and we were able to measure that the sound that caused the greatest vibration inside of that chulpa was either 432 or 440 hertz, which is A, the note A. And that's also the same sound that causes the vibration in the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid. And so it's also supposedly the natural vibration of the earth.
Oh, all right. Okay, so it doesn't look to be random.
No, not at all.
Oh, all right. I wanted to cover some of the monuments in or strange structures in Peru. You review some of the water channels in Peru, and they are quite fascinating. In some of your videos, we can see well, first of all, water was quite important for the Incas and probably for all cultures who inhabited this region, because they were doing their agriculture in terraces, so that it was important for them to keep the water in place. But some of the structures which you show are quite astonishing. Some of the channels are cut in rock, And even when the builders reach a large chunk of rock, they still cut right through it, and they didn't cut in the, let's say, the simplest of ways, just to make sure the water was able to flow. They cut the entire rock, the side of the rock, so that they can clear a way for the channels. Can you share with us some of your impressions of those channels?
Yeah, the most impressive one is actually near the more northern city of Cajamarca, and it's called Cumbe Mayo, and it's an aqueduct that is carved into the bedrock. Presently, it is, I think, about 8 kilometers long, but at both ends, it's simply filled in with dirt and sediment, and so it could be much, much longer. And it has these interesting zigzag patterns, like it will either curve or go in a straight line, and then there's the zigzag pattern in it, and then it continues on, either going straight or in a curve. And it's a very strange looking thing. I've measured. I took a ruler with me and measured. They're very even, very straight. I couldn't see any tool marks. So either it was done with very advanced technology, or it's so ancient that the tool marks are gone. The archaeologists can only guess as to who made it. It wasn't made by a culture that had possibly even bronze tools. So again, it's a strange thing out in the middle of basically nowhere. I'm very eager to go back again, because one trip to a place is never really satisfactory. It only gives you an impression. But to go back and find both ends of it and see if I can measure how long that aqueduct system is.
You probably weren't able to measure the angles, but is it safe to say 90 degree angles on some of the turns?
Yeah, actually, in the case of the Cumbe Mayo Aqueduct, it was 90 degrees. But what we find in many of the other sites is that whoever these builders were, they were not they weren't really interested in straight lines at all or 90 degree angles. And that's especially the case at Pumapunku in Bolivia. Almost nothing is a 90 degree angle, but very precise angles were used. I've been there 15 times, and I'm still. I leave it as confused every time I go as the first time, because it's so complicated.
and the worst part of it, there's not much left. Well, this is what I've seen in your videos and on some of the documentaries. Everything is shattered around. There is Tiwanaku, right? But Pumapunku mm-hmm. is actually a place which is nearby and which supposedly is much, much more ancient than Tiwanaku. Can you speculate on the reasons behind this, catastrophe that happened in Pumapunku?
Well, it's really complicated. The thing that I believe I found out is that Tiwanaku and Pumapunku are actually the same site.
Oh.
It's just they put a fence around Pumapunku. But because the gray andesite that was used, which ancient aliens called diorite, it's the oldest stone that was used there. The quarry has been found, most likely. It's about 70 kilometers away. Some of these stones are, many tons. The surfaces are so flat that, again, they're within 2/10,000ths of an inch of being perfectly flat. The one good thing is that Pumapunku and Tiwanaku, probably at the same time, were hit by a giant, what seems like almost like a tidal wave of mud. And so much of it was buried, and most of it still is buried in the ground. And so the mud helped to protect the stone from being weathered by rain and the sun. But it's a very, very amazing place. It was abandoned at about the year 1000 AD by the Tiwanakan culture. And so people have been using it as a stone quarry ever since. The saddest part was the later part of the 19th century, when they did use dynamite to blow it up because they were building a railroad next to it, and they used the stone to put the railway line on top of.
I see, I see. But you mentioned something there. You mentioned that most of it is still underground. I know that the pyramid in Tiwanaku is most of it is still underground, and they're doing excavations. What about those remnants in Pumapunku itself? Are most of them discovered? Could there be something else somewhere around?
I think there's a lot more. The thing is, they just haven't. I don't know why, but they aren't giving much in terms of permits to do too much excavation. But the places where they have done some archaeological digs going down as much as a meter, you can see perfectly precision stones sticking out of the sides of these things. So I think much of Pumapunku is still buried. They have been uncovering the foundation around the perimeter of it, and that stonework is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the site is covered in earth in mud, maybe quite a few feet in some places, which means that it probably wasn't just an earthquake which destroyed this building. Something much more massive happened in this place, and probably that ties in with what happened with Peru. Pumapunku is in Bolivia, of course, but in Pumapunku we see similar. Sorry, in Peru we see similar destruction, and specifically in Ollantaytambo, where we can see some massive stones which were basically thrown out of alignment. Do you think that there's any similarities between Ollantaytambo and Pumapunku?
I honestly believe that that the damage that we see at Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo and Pumapunku and Silistani all happened at the same time, because the damage seems to be in an east-west direction, not north-south. So it seems like there was either a massive earthquake that happened on a huge scale, or it could have been the result of a major catastrophe that happened globally, we believe, at the end of the last ice age about 11,700 years ago. It's possible that the Earth's axis was thrown out of alignment at that time, and that would have caused global damage. So, in the case of Ollantaytambo, that's the sun temple, so-called sun temple you're referring to. The conventional story is that the Inca never got around to finishing it. That's why it looks like the state it's in. But you can find these multi-ton blocks were literally thrown like styrofoam, all over the place. The Inca recycled part of it to build stairways. But I think most definitely we're looking at a catastrophic event that happened thousands of years before the Inca existed.
Well, we know what's the traditional view on that, but you're in contact with some of the native, let's call them wisdom keepers. What do they think about those strange monuments?
Well, the few people that still exist in the Cusco area that I've been able to talk to, unfortunately, the Spanish conquest, along with Catholicism or the Catholic Church, managed, very well to destroy a lot of the knowledge, but some of it still exists. And what they speak of is they speak of a race of people, either called the Viracochas or the Piruas. That's where Peru gets its name from, and that they lived in the very distant past. They were highly intelligent. They were the original builders of these structures, and that they possibly were either the descendants of those that were destroyed by this global cataclysm, or they, in fact, some of the buildings may have been built before the cataclysm, and the level of devastation was so great that most of them were, basically killed.
Yeah, Viracocha. Was it a culture or just one person? I know that there is a statue of Viracocha in Pumapunku, and Viracocha is also called the bearded one because he appears to have a beard on his face, which is not very typical of the local population to have a large beard. Was it a culture?
I believe so. The thing is that you really have to read, or you have to either read or learn as much of the oral tradition as possible, because you'll get very like different stories. Viracocha is described as being the creator, and so in that way he was God and did not have a physical form. But then in other stories, they speak of more than one of them that actually walked around, like it was in human form. And they are spoken of as being the great teachers who educated all of the lesser sophisticated cultures to the north. The Viracochas originated or lived around the Lake Titicaca, as in Puma Punku Tiwanaku area, and then they migrated north. And as they were migrating or traveling, they taught the sciences and arts to the people that they came in contact with. So I think they were a race of people.
And while we're talking about major cataclysms, we can see in the pyramid of Egypt, because of your videos and other material, that there are major cracks. Something quite extraordinary happened in Egypt as well, which probably ties in with what happened in Peru if it was a global catastrophe. What evidence have you come across to suggest that whatever the pyramids were used for stopped in a heartbeat because of a major event?
Well, exactly. The other thing is that what we found is that the most of the stone monuments in Peru and Bolivia are situated on natural earth energy lines, and it's quite possible that the Great Pyramid and other structures in Egypt are as well. And so they were built on purpose because they were in some way using or harnessing the energy of the earth. Not, I don't think, for electricity, but just, some kind of subtle energy. And I think this catastrophic event of 12,000 years ago may have caused the Earth's axis to change, and that changed the alignment of the relationship between the energy and the structure. And so there may have actually been explosions that happened. The Chulpas at Silistani are, I think, a classic example of that, because the largest of them, which was in fact square and composed of multi-ton blocks, one whole side wall of that literally looks like it was thrown hundreds of meters, like the stones were thrown hundreds of meters off towards the west direction. And it looks like something that literally exploded.
I think you mentioned east-west direction before in relation to Ollanta Tambo. So is it
Right.
the same situation there? Big chunks of stone thrown in west direction.
In
Silistani in the Chulpas.
yes, exactly. Yeah, the same at we see that at Machu Picchu, we see that in Cusco, we see that at Ollanta Tambo, we see it at Silistani, and I'll be looking for more when I go back in a few days.
Sure. I guess a pattern emerges there, which ties all those places in together. I wanted to mention a special person. He has something to do with Egypt. His name is Abdel Hakim Awiyan. He passed on a few years back. But he's a very special person in terms of influencing a lot of the younger generation, such as I guess yourself and Stephen Mailer. Can you say a few words about Abdel?
Sure. I didn't actually have the chance to meet him because he died, I think, 5 years ago. But I'm very well acquainted with his family. In fact, they've adopted me and treat me like a brother. What made Hakim very special was that he began to study the sites of ancient Egypt, I think, when he was about 6 years old. And over the course of his life, he was a professional, or he was a tour guide for, I think, 50 years, He also had two university degrees in Egyptology and archaeology. And what he had the ability to do was each one of the sites in Egypt is taken care of by usually an old man. They're like the custodian of the place. And so he had the opportunity to develop friendships with them. And from them, he was able to learn the ancient knowledge of what the actual reasoning behind the buildings was. And the story that he learned varies very greatly in a lot of instances with what Egyptology has to say. I'm not a, you know, I very much am thankful that the Egyptologists have done all the work that they have, that they know so much about the dynastic Egyptians and pharaohs and what they achieved. But some of these buildings don't fit in with the story that they tell, such as the Giza pyramids, Serapeum, and the Osirion, for example. They seem to be several thousand years older than the dynastic Egyptians, and that's where there is some kind of I would say tension between Egyptologists and those who are not Egyptologists, because I honestly believe, I honestly believe that the pyramids were not built by slaves during the time of the dynastic Egyptians. I think they were built by a technically highly advanced culture several thousand years before that, and they were energetic structures of some kind. But whoever these people were, their mindset was very different from ours. So it's difficult to decode what they were doing, but that is my pursuit and the pursuit of the Awiyans.
Sure. I know that Hakim has been doing a lot of work. Other people have as well, such as Dr. Robert Schoch and his famous statements in the early 1990s. But as far as I see, there is little progress in terms of mainstream historians and archaeologists accepting his point of view that, well, the pyramids and the Sphinx in particular are much more ancient than what we believe. I find this strange. How come nobody has debunked his theory, as far as I know, but still it's not widely accepted. Why is it this way?
Well, I think it's the old-fashioned thing that, like, the way we were raised is the idea that someone who is supposedly a specialist at something, such as an Egyptologist, is the expert. But the trouble is that most Egyptologists have probably never worked with stone, like a stonemason has. They're not experts in geology, like someone like Robert Schoch is. So they can't give an expert opinion on something like why does the body of the Sphinx have so much weathering to it? Robert Schoch's idea, which is now backed up by 200 other geologists around the world, is that it was eroded by water and not by wind and sand, but by water. So what climatologists have been able to figure out is that the only time there was a lot of rainfall where the Sphinx is would have been 10,000 years ago. Or even farther back in time. And so if the Sphinx is eroded by rainwater, then obviously it has to be 10,000 or more years old.
And then historians tell you, where is the culture? You can't just throw this in. Where is the culture? And the answer of the scientists is, well, you have to look at the evidence. Obviously, this was eroded by water, so you have to find you have to find the culture. And I guess we still haven't found a very concrete example of this culture, of this culture, which would be, I guess, a game changer. I think you, Brian, and some of the other people that we mentioned, you're working in this direction to change people's perception about our history and specifically our ancient history. You have been involved with a couple of research projects. One of them is the testing of the elongated skulls of Peru, of Paracas. How is this going? Is there any new results from this research?
Well, basically, there was the initial result that the geneticists found, that there seem to be segments of DNA that don't match anything known as far as humanity is concerned. But because of that, of course, there was a lot of controversy. What we're doing now is actually we have quite possibly raised $250,000 in order to do a very detailed study of this. And we're negotiating with the geneticist. We're also working with a Peruvian archaeologist to get samples taken out of Peru to be sent to a laboratory in the United States to have this studied in a very deep and thorough way. So that's more or less where it is as of right now.
Okay, and I guess quite a lot of money is involved with those with this kind of research. You mentioned a sum there. Have you managed to acquire all the necessary funds, or are you still looking for support?
Actually, at this point, I think we're fine. What most people don't know is the fact that studying ancient DNA is very expensive because DNA is an organic material, and so it breaks down over time. So you need the latest ultimate computer software and DNA testing equipment in order to properly basically it's reassembling the DNA as a in a computer program in order to recombine it. And that's why it's so costly. Also because it's such a controversial subject, a lot of laboratories won't take it on, but we're very fortunate in that we have a very professional laboratory in the United States that has agreed to do the testing for us.
I would like to say thank you to this lab and the people there, and all the people who have pitched in to support you guys in your project. I guess there is a long list of people who have done that. And this is one of the research projects that you're involved with. The other is the cosmogenic testing of ancient stone from Pumapunku in Bolivia. Can you say a few words about this?
Sure. One of our associates, David Swenson, got in contact with Purdue University, who has the capability of doing cosmogenic testing, which is the measuring of the amount of cosmic radiation which has struck and penetrated exposed stone. So it's a very expensive, well, it's not that expensive really. It's about $3,000 per sample, but it's kind of the opposite of carbon 14 testing. Carbon 14 testing is where you're measuring the decay rate of radioactive carbon, whereas cosmogenic testing is the buildup or conversion of compounds and elements into a beryllium component. And so, unfortunately, as soon as the funding was ready, Purdue just announced that they wouldn't do the testing. And I think they were influenced by someone from the outside. But we are now in contact with other laboratories around the world, and hopefully within a week or two, we'll have one that will do the testing for
Oh,
us.
that's great. So the research here is not completely stalled.
No, and the thing is, we're in both cases with the DNA testing and the cosmogenic testing, just because we have been rejected by, one or two laboratories, it's not going to stop us. We're going to get to the truth.
It's like a bug which gets into under your skin, and
Yes.
I guess you can't let it go.
No.
I wanted to ask you about your tours. Obviously, you have a very good site. It's called hiddenincatours.com, and you organize and do tour guides around Peru and other parts of the world. Is there something upcoming this year? Have you planned something?
Yeah, we have actually a tour on the coast of Peru in May of the places where some of the elongated skulls were found. That tour is full. In September, we have a major tour of Peru and Bolivia, including Machu Picchu, Pumapunku, etc. And we're bringing two of the Awiyans from Egypt to travel with us,
No.
because they've
Okay.
never seen the ancient megalithic work in Peru, and I think it'll be very educational. That one's still open. And then late October, we have Hugh Newman and Megalithomania coming back. I think this is the fourth time in a row. We're doing the same sites in Peru and Bolivia, so people are welcome to join either of those two
Oh,
tours.
that's great. Do you have still tickets, places for these tours?
Sure.
Oh, all right. Okay, I'll start saving right now.
Good.
It's been a dream of mine to do that. So I'll probably do it. Maybe not this year, but hopefully in the near future. Brian, I'd like to thank you for being with me today. I would also like to thank you for, well, in general, what you're doing and for expanding our awareness and our consciousness. And basically, I wish you all the best in your endeavors.
Well, thank you very much, and I think it's our right as human beings to know our real history, and that's what I and many other people are working at collectively, that we unravel these mysteries because we have the right to know this information.
Sure. Well, thanks a lot, and hopefully we'll be able to speak again sometimes in the future.
Sure,
For
thank you.
sure. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.